agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
Mike, I'm feeling like I'm a Texas voter on a Sunday morning, just just waiting for the polls open to get out there and do my thing and enjoy the weekend.
There, there you go. All right. Well, we will certainly talk a little bit about that. But before we get to that, the first thing we always want to do is thank our latest supporters on Patreon, Christopher and Brandon. And also I wanted to mention Jen, who recently became a Patreon supporter of the show. She wrote in to say, I hesitated joining before as I didn't really need an additional podcast. I know how that feels. She said, but I've
Can't
been
blame me, Jen.
But she said, I've been supporting more podcasts and I wanted to include yours. And we really do appreciate that. So thank you very much. Also,
yes, in all seriousness.
Thanks. Yeah, absolutely. And we also had a new supporter on Venmo, David. Thank you, David. And of course, you guys know that as a Patreon supporter, you get that second full-length episode every week. You get ad-free versions of all our shows, other things at different levels of support. Just to check it out, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if financial issues are preventing you from supporting a show, but you would like that midweek show, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up. And as I mentioned, you can also support us through Venmo. We're at Politics Guys. And on today's show, Jay and I are going to be talking about voting rights in Texas, as Jay just alluded to. And I think also the consequences, both in the state and nationally, of that likely new law, why many businesses are struggling to find workers, and what, if anything, government can or should do about it. The big rise in crime over the last year, and depending on how much time we have, we might even get the Pride Month and Florida's new transgender sports ban. So we will get to that in just 1 minute. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. Okay, Jay, so as you suggested in the opening, we are going to be starting off this week by talking about things in Texas.
Yes, so our first story, Mike, as most people know, the Texas legislature is sort of inches away from passing a new voting law, which some have described President Biden, most conspicuous among them, as un-American and an assault on democracy. The bill was set to go to a vote last week when Texas Democrats walked out, depriving the legislature of a quorum. Now, the next step is the governor can call for a special session, which he is going to do if he hasn't officially done so already, which would require them to show up. And you know, most observers believe that the bill will be voted on and approved. So parts of this bill, and again, this is something that you and I can get into. One, it would roll back drive-through 24-hour voting, which was used in Harris County in Texas. That's the Houston area during the 2020 pandemic. It would expand 2 weeks of early voting, set hours for that. There'll be 12 hours on weekdays, 6 hours on weekends. It would also expand that early voting from counties with 100,000 people in population to those with 30,000. Would require state ID numbers, or a last four digits of Social Security number for mail-in voting. There's a whole lot of things.
There's a lot it would do. I think it's something like 67 pages. Yeah,
one of them. Employers would be barred from refusing to excuse workers during early voting week to go vote. It would change the rules in terms of whether votes should be invalidated from clear and convincing to a preponderance of the evidence. And probably the provision that's gotten the most attention, it would change the Sunday early voting. The polls would open at 1 p.m. under the current version. Now, there's been some talk in the last couple of days that that might be walked back. There was also a suggestion that the 1 p.m. was a typo and it should have been 11 a.m. But regardless, those are the key provisions. And I, again, there are a lot more in there. But well, I guess, Mike, my question to you is, you know, legislation good or bad, do you think this is an assault on democracy?
Yeah, I just one quick thing. I want to, I know listeners will want to would take me to task for not mentioning a couple of other provisions that I think on the left, and that would be the giving poll watchers a little bit more freedom inside polling places, and that some folks take an issue with that, and also making it a felony to send out unsolicited absentee ballot applications. But yeah, go back to your general question there. That language, you know, in the New Republic this week, there was an article called "The Overthrow of American Democracy Begins in Texas." Just this morning, I looked at The Guardian, saw an article called "Is America Heading to a Place Where It Can No Longer Call Itself a Democracy?" And you know, Jay, that I've often criticized you and those on the right for slippery slope arguments. And it would be, I think, hypocritical of me not to level the same criticism at people on the left who are, I understand, they're trying to sell, well, clicks or, you know, subscriptions or what have you. And so, no, I do not see this as Jim Crow 2.0 or Jim Crow on steroids or the end of American democracy.
Well, one reference, Jim Crow in a tuxedo.
That's a new one to me. That's,
which I'm not sure I really understand.
I don't know what that means. No,
not
but
sure anyone understood Jim Crow on steroids, but yeah, go ahead.
But no, I think it's easy. I understand why it is the hyperbole is being used. And I certainly do not believe it's a move in the right direction. But I guess that, you know, obviously we see this on both sides. Everything that the other side is doing is the end of democracy. It's either on the right, what we tend to hear, I think, is, well, socialism is, you know, it's the favorite word, I think. Everything that anyone on the left wants to do is clearly we're bringing socialism to America. And, you know, I think it's really...
We'll get to that in the labor shortage
discussion. Yeah. I think that's really unfortunate, but I understand what's driving it. But no, I think it's important that if we want to push back against that, we have to be willing to do it on our own side as well. And so I would hope you would agree that for the most part, the Democratic Party is not intent on bringing full-throated socialism to the United States. And I, you know, I don't believe that, you know, what we are seeing in Texas and Georgia and other states is the end of democracy. But that being said, I don't think it's a good thing. And I think that it is intended. I mean, we've seen this template in a number of states now. They've all been Republican states. And it seems to me that there's a clear pattern. Early voting is expanded in a smaller, more rural areas that just coincidentally happen to have more Republican voters, and it's restricted in more urban areas, which just coincidentally happen to have more likely Democratic voters. And I'm sure.
But in this case, it's not. It's. I mean, there aren't new restrictions in urban areas. It's just there's an expansion into more rural areas. I mean, and shouldn't if the idea is let's make it easier for everybody to vote, shouldn't that be okay?
Well, yeah, and I would say, you know, it's interesting to me that for generations, one sort of article of faith among conservatives is this idea of subsidiarity. Jay, you're familiar with that term. It's basically this idea of allowing
big word, Mike.
But yeah, you know, allowing governments at the level closest to the people to make these decisions. And so, you know, it occurs to me that, well, if you want governments at the level closest to the people to make these decisions, well, then Harris County should be allowed to, you know, make these decisions about voting. But, you know, the state of Texas clearly is not okay with subsidiarity, with local control in this issue. And I think it's because, well, a couple of things. I think it's certainly because these are Democratic areas, and that's the main thing. I also think it's a response to their kind of core of voters who falsely believe that there are all sorts of problems with elections. And so they are addressing that belief, that false perception on the part of their core supporters. And so I think that's largely what's going on, you know, and I think it's not surprising that ostensible principles are giving way to, you know, what the party's voters want.
So because I think that's a good point, the subsidiarity argument. And My sense from the right, I think the response would be yes. I would, and I think most conservatives, most Republicans do see that as, look, the government, the level of the government that is closest to you governs best, for a whole lot of reasons. You know, basically because if you're mad at the school board or the city council, you can show up on a meeting and let them know about it, or you run into your representative at the grocery store or what have you. But there's a more close relation and more, therefore, presumably, theoretically, more accountability. Also, yeah, people at the local level, it's if you don't like your city council person or something, you can put together a campaign and run yourself, or you know, send a couple hundred bucks to somebody who's running, and it might make a big difference compared to saying I want to oust my sitting senator. But I do think there's also a counter argument on something like elections, where you want to have there is some sort of uniformity that's required, particularly when we're talking about you know, going into federal elections. So I get the subsidiary that argument that maybe we're better off with local control, but I do think there needs to be some basic statewide standards. Otherwise, you do risk the problem of some people in some counties have more rights, have more access than others. That said, I mean, in fairness, you pointed out where you think your side is overstepping. To me, I look at this as the Sunday voting. First of all, one, I'll start with, I think this is completely overblown and silly and ridiculous. And it's also a little demeaning, I think, that the idea that, well, people can't get to the polls unless they go to church first and then they're driven to the polls. And also, those conservative, I really... There's something wonderful in that the government is or the left is sort of admitting it's easier for people to get to church to interact with the church than it is to interact with the state. But all that said, I think the way this was handled was flat-footed and dumb. Now, Harris County Sunday voting last year started at 12 o'clock. This year it would be 1 o'clock. Supposing they move it back to 11, either way, I mean, I don't see this as an assault on democracy, or something that is, you know, so racially tinged that you know, it requires a civil rights investigation. But that said, I think it's dumb. It could have been handled better. And my guess is that that Sunday provision does get walked back with probably an earlier start time. You know, at the same time, I think, look, there's some practical considerations in terms of how often, you know, how long you can keep polls open. You have to pay poll workers. You have to keep facilities open. And look, a couple of weeks ago. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, on that issue, you know, it seems to me that if the intent were solely election security, and, you know, that we're keeping with that ideal of limited regulation, local control, it seems to me that legislation then, instead of outright banning things, would set certain standards saying that, hey, if Harris County wants to open the polls on Sunday at 6 a.m., as long as they meet these standards for security and poll workers, well, that's within their rights to go ahead and do that, and we're not going to step in and interfere. Because if this is about election security, then it seems to me there's nothing wrong about 24-hour or drive-through voting or any other type of thing you want to put together, so long as the county takes sufficient precautions to ensure that those votes are secure. And so that to me seems to be much more in line with a traditional Republican approach to light regulation, as opposed to the sort of heavy-handed, you will not do this sort of approach.
The heavy-handedness in the bill, it says that every county with 30,000 people or more shall provide at least 12 hours of early voting during the week and at least 6 hours during the weekend. Now, I think there's also a provision in there that says the general period of time for those voting hours should be between 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. And it's up to local counties to figure out whether they want to start at 6 and go to 6, or they can start at 6, go to 9, however, start at 8, go to 9. And I'll say, so I read up on this, the Harris County experience in the drive-through voting. And again, this is something that was created just last year because of the pandemic. The idea being you can just drive up in your car, you're handed a disinfected electronic voting machine, like laptop type thing, not a, huge voting machine. And you can vote without leaving your car, or it also allows for walk up and so forth. You show a photo ID. So there are, security provisions there. And as I read about it, I didn't see it as practiced in Harris County, at least, as a tremendous risk in terms of voter fraud. The concern, I think that it does present some practical issues, though, in terms of if you're going to do this county or statewide, having those people manning those polls, all these places, all the time. I think that could be a problem. And also, I guess I am a little concerned in that, do we really need to, are people being disenfranchised, or the better word that I think you used, suppressed? If you can't vote at 3 a.m. on a Thursday night, I guess that's sort of my question. It seems that the, I guess nothing good happens after 2 a.m. So I think there are some concerns with, the late night after hours voting type situations. And again, how it's handled, right? The Harris County experience, which seems to be all electronic, I think is something different than unmonitored drop boxes. What I'm saying is I don't see that as a huge security threat. I do see it as if you're looking to have some sort of state uniformity, because a lot of the other counties in Texas might not have the resources that Harris County has. I think there's an issue there.
Well, I think other counties, obviously don't have the population as well. And so when you're dealing with greater population density and different populations, different things might work better or worse, which again goes back to that argument for, subsidiarity. But to your point about sort of equal conditions across the state, I actually think there are a lot. In fact, I know that there are a lot of people who on the left who would not just agree with you, but who would argue to expand that, saying that, well, exactly.
People on the left never agree with me.
Well, there you go. But the idea being that, yes, that and in national elections, that there should be equal conditions, not just within a state, but across the country for voting, say, for president. Now, I know you would probably argue that, well, people don't actually vote for president. They vote for electors in their state, and it's a state sort of thing. But, of course, a lot of folks on the left would say, well, no, this is de facto, a national election. These are national political decisions. And so, therefore, some people would even argue that it rises to the level of, equal protection violations if it is substantially more difficult for certain people to vote simply because they happen to be living in, say, Georgia or Texas, as opposed to Ohio or something like that.
Well, two things. First of all, I would argue that the difference is the Constitution assigns to the states to make their own voting rights, not to the federal government. They make their own voting rules, not to the federal government.
Let me just say, before you go on that, though, actually, what the Constitution says is the states can do that, but Congress can legislate on that as well. So it's not a state; it's not a right that is given specifically to the states. The states can, but so can the federal government. And I think it's important to point that out.
But only, and the federal government only as to federal elections.
Right, only as to federal elections. Yeah. Absolutely, only for congressional and presidential races. Yes.
Yeah. The idea is, look, the states were voting before there was a federal government, and they brought those practices in there. The Constitution recognized that states can set their own rules for voting. Now, I think you're exactly right that obviously there can be equal protection issues. But do we start getting into a weird slippery slope of equal protection issues where if you say, hey, look, they got all night voting in Texas. But hey, where I am, I have to stop voting. I can only vote till 2 a.m.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that argument.
You know, I mean, I think that's the problem is you keep, you know, if you want to say, look, there is a baseline of, you know, democracy here that people need to participate. And obviously we shouldn't allow, things that are intended to lock people out of the system, literacy tests, poll taxes, all those things that the Voting Rights Act got rid of. But at the same time, just because you might have the slightest inconvenience, you know, in terms of, hey, I have to go do this to vote as opposed to I'm going to have a poll worker come personally to my house and help me fill out my ballot. I think that's the problem. And rhetorically, every time there are these changes, you know, whether you want to call them restrictions or expansions, that's the rhetoric that's out there as well. Look, somebody else can vote anytime they want. You know, well, I want to, you know, water there's a lack of vegan options in the voting line. I mean, that kind of thing.
Sure.
That it just keeps expanding to the point of being silly.
Yeah, no. And I, you know, I appreciate that. I also appreciate that a lot of these changes, like the drop boxes and like the drive-through voting, were done in response to very unique circumstances, yeah, of the pandemic. And so it's not unreasonable for someone to say, well, then what's the objection? If there was no objection to the pre-pandemic procedures, what's the objection to going back to those procedures? Now, what a lot of folks on the left would say is, well, as long as there is no major, as long as there is no significant issue with fraud, then we should do everything we can to make voting as frictionless as possible. And I know that there are, for a number of grounds, you have some issues with that. And I understand.
I think there ought to be some friction. Yeah. I don't know, not significant friction, but it ought to be an intentional act and people ought to be, it shouldn't be just my fear, and again, you're going to say this is a slippery slope, but you know, at what point, I mean, again, going back to the, you know, the civil rights movement, and you know, John Lewis getting his head bashed in, marching for the right to vote, and now we've got it's sort of devolved into, oh, this is just like Jim Crow when we're talking about opening the polls on Sundays, which, you know, that's a new thing. You know, and while they're going to open at 1 instead of noon, you know, again, this is the end of democracy. That's what troubles me. And again, I think you're being, very intellectually honest on this, that, look, you can say I think this is a good idea, bad idea.
Yeah,
but it's not. Yeah, it's not the end of democracy.
And that's kind of how I see it. Yeah,
yeah, and I think those who are saying that, I think that's problematic. Just as on the other side, people who are saying that the election is stolen is problematic. So, yeah.
You know, another issue related to this I wanted to ask you about is Democrats walking out deny a quorum. I think a lot of people would wonder, well, how does that work? Because typically a quorum is a majority of
just
those present. But yeah, but actually Texas and a couple of other states in their state legislatures have quorum requirements of 2/3. And so Democrats could just, you know, walk out, which is what they did to at least delay the inevitable, really. But I think that, you know, to try to send a message and publicize this sort of thing. But I wanted to get your take on that, because I could hear some folks on the right saying, well, isn't that hypocritical? Aren't Democrats subverting the democratic process in response to maybe what they see as a perceived subversion of the democratic process on the other end? Is it? Yeah. What do you think about that?
I don't think it's a subversion of the democratic process. Look, it's allowed for in the rules, and there's a remedy for it in the rules, which is the special session. So look, they're playing their cards as that they have, And they did this. I mean, obviously, it was a publicity kind of attention calling thing. But look, that's part of the process. So I don't have a huge issue with the way it worked in Texas. And I'd compare that with Wisconsin back during the Scott Walker days, where there were Democrats who were fleeing and their quorum requirements were different. Who were fleeing and hiding, and the governor sent out the highway patrol to try to find them. And, I think that in that case, in the Wisconsin case, it was more of a subversion of democracy because they were trying to really stop the wheels where there was no other way to do it. There's going to, essentially going on strike, not doing their job. But in Texas, I think it sort of gives you the ability to do this, protest essentially. And that's what they did. And, on the merits, I don't agree with it, but, I don't think it's undemocratic, right? Cause it's still, you're playing by the rules and,
right.
And you're not subverting, there's going to be a vote eventually. So to me, it doesn't strike me as any more democratic subversion than just the rules committee saying we're going to refer this back to the, standing committee for more review and that kind of thing. So,
and I should point out, this isn't something that just Democrats do. And for instance, over in Oregon, they also have that 2/3 quorum requirement. And as it is a Democratic dominated legislature, Republicans, I think 4 or 5 times in the last couple of years had done the same sort of walkout thing, for similar reason, not for voting things, but for various things. So the one other thing I wanted to ask you about, Jay, with this is, it seems that President Biden has really, in a way, at least to a certain extent, up the pressure on particularly Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. He mentioned, my two colleagues who vote more often with the other side than with us, which actually is not the case. They're pretty much party line voters. But, I should also point out that Joe Manchin is the only Senate Democrat who hasn't co-sponsored the For the People Act. So not only is he against the filibuster, he's changing the filibuster. He's also against that legislation, which would essentially override a lot of these state laws. And
it's against the people, Mike. That's what it sounds like to me.
Well, it occurred to me.
You're not for the people, you're against them.
Well, I mean, if you look back, the big question, I think, is, what is, for a lot of Democrats, is what does Joe Manchin want? It's pretty clear to me that if he does kind of cave to this pressure for whatever reason, this is going to be his last term in the Senate. He won in 2012 with just over 60% of the vote. But then in 2018, he got just under 50% of the vote. And if the Libertarian candidate hadn't picked up, I think, a little over 4%, he might not have, won at all. And, in 2024, when he's up again, he's going to be 76 years old, which is getting up there. But, unfortunately, my party has kind of a gerontocracy thing going on there. And so I sort of understand that he's, I think, at some level, from a practical politics standpoint, if he wants another term, there's no way he's getting another term if he gives in on this issue, especially if he said very clearly in that Washington Post, I believe it was, editorial a few months ago, that he will not support not just ending the filibuster, but weakening it in any way. So, I'm not going to go back on my prediction that the filibuster will somehow be changed. I don't know if Manchin is going to find a way to do that. I think the pressure will eventually get to the point where he will be persuaded to make some sort of an exception, maybe for voting rights. I don't know, but we'll see. That's kind of my take on that.
Well, I'm just saying, here we are. If you remember back before the election, I mean, so many Republicans were saying, if Biden's elected, it's and the Senate goes to Democrats or even close, they're going to push to eliminate the filibuster. They're going to wipe it out, and then it's just going to be they will run roughshod over the Republic. And the response is, no, come on, that's crazy. Nobody wants to do that. And Biden even said, no, he's not interested in doing that. And here we are. So I think there's an argument about you know, nuking the filibuster. I mean, you could go back and ask Harry Reid, how did that work out?
You know, I was actually thinking about that. And that, for judicial appointments. And that just the history of that is back in 2013, Reid was majority leader. Democrats had a majority and were deeply frustrated by Republican intransigence in confirming not just appellate court judges, but actually a number of district court judges. And so they went with what was called at the time, now it just seems like a tactical nuclear option, but the nuclear option of ending the filibuster for judicial appointments. And one of the few Democrats who wasn't in support of that was actually Joe Manchin. And, you know, it's easy to play what if, because, of course, then after that, Republicans ended the filibuster on Supreme Court nominations, citing Reid and that precedent. But certainly, I would think that the federal judiciary would be in a better place from my perspective if it still took 60 votes to confirm a judge, whether Supreme Court or, you know, or just a district judge. But we are not there, and I'll admit that I am conflicted over this, because I certainly can see a situation in which it's, you know, January of 2025, and, you know, was it President DeSantis, and like I said, the Republicans controlling the House and Senate, and all sorts of stuff passing without that filibuster that Democrats, my party, would desperately want to have. So it can definitely come back and bite you, you know.
Well, and again, I don't understand the rush towards this. And I guess it troubles me a little bit.
I can explain the rush, Jay. And the rush is that a lot of people on the left believe that these changes in voting laws in a number of states are going to fundamentally reset the electorate in a deeply unfair way that will, you know, unfairly increase the sort of structural advantage that conservatives, that Republicans have. And I guess
could turn the clock back to 2014.
Well, yeah, I'm a little more sanguine about this, because it seems to me that all the research that I've seen suggests that while this can have a marginal effect, it's not the sort of large-scale effect that is going to be likely to make in these sort of broad changes. And so I'm concerned about it. I don't think it's a move in the right direction, but I don't think it's going to basically unfairly, unjustly install Republicans in power for the next generation or something like that. I mean, if I were the Democratic Party, I'm much more concerned about voter registration and inroads that Republicans are making with the Hispanic population and that sort of thing. That's the sort of thing that I think is going to have much greater impact than these voting changes, which I do think will give an advantage to Republicans, but pretty much at the margins. Of course, in close elections, those margins can matter quite a lot. As some people have pointed out, that, you know, even though Joe Biden got millions more votes than Donald Trump, I think something like 40-something thousand strategically placed votes going the other way in various areas, and all of a sudden Donald Trump is in a second term.
Yeah. So, I think that's right. And my response to those is getting rid of the filibuster, though, goes beyond voting rights.
Yeah.
Right. And I think in some cases, the idea of well, we have to do this to save voting rights, to save democracy, is cover for, well, we just want to be freaking in charge of everything. Right. I mean, it's not also about Green New Deals and all sorts of other Democratic policy issues. And I think someone would, I mean, unless you're just really bad at math, and maybe Manchin is the only one who gets it, with the Senate, you know, one vote one way or the other, this would seem particularly ill-timed. You know, has anybody checked how Patrick Leahy's feeling lately? If I'm a Democrat, unless the idea is to, and this is the way so many conservatives see it, the rush they see is, look, Democrats want to seize power right now so they can start doing things that will give them the permanent advantage that sure, you just said that Democrats fear. And those would be things like, well, we'll add a couple states and we will completely take over the way states vote, and we'll see what we can do about the Electoral College and so forth. So I think that's why so many Republicans see the rush towards this as well, there must be something up.
Yeah, and I agree with that, though I also agree with the fundamental worldview behind that Democratic position, which is that, yes, that would give an advantage to Democrats, but it's an advantage that's based on the will of the people in general, as opposed to, I think, a more Republican view is that, well, no, we have these federalist, these state-based structures, and so it doesn't matter that Joe Biden wins the election by X million votes because states have rights. And Democrats, we tend not to look at it in terms of states' rights. We tend to look at it in terms more of individual rights in that sense. And so that's, I think, individual rights in terms of voting.
I'm not looking at states' rights. I'm looking at it as, and you mentioned sort of the will of the people. And to me, that's what it sort of boils down to is, well, who do you want in charge, James Madison or Jean-Jacques Rousseau? I'll go with Madison.
Yeah, I would argue that the choice is not nearly that stark. You know, certainly I don't think that most Republicans or most Democrats are that far left any more than I think that, you know, there certainly are some Republicans that are very far right. But, you know,
I'm talking about I'm not talking about the rank and file voters. I'm talking more, you know, the intellectual, you know, like the you and me of the parties, right? I mean, how do they look at this? And if the one is looking at it as this is a constitutional system and that's the rule, them's the rules we're playing by, versus look, no, there's a free floating will of the people and that's what we ought to follow. That's the distinction I'm making.
Sure. Yeah. And I think they're, you know, reasonable people can have differences of opinion as to the extent of the, you might call them guardrails. Some would call them restrictions on the will of the people. And for the most part,
that's the whole point of constitutional government, right? Is that, look, the will of the people, you can't trust those knuckleheads. And likewise, you can't trust, it's sort of, this is very much balancing, right? Of you can't trust just the populace at large, but nor can you trust the elite.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the genius of the Constitution, right? It sort of has both working, and you have the House, which is does respond to the more populist passions of the day. And then you have the Senate, which
does the same thing now. Theoretically.
Exactly. Originally, Washington's, language was the cooling saucer.
Yeah, yeah, not so much
anymore.
The
T of the, because that's how people talked back then, instead of talking about assaults on democracy. But you have a president, but the president is indirectly elected. Because of the fears that you may have a demagogue take over.
Yeah.
That's sort of a bigger. Well, you and I sort of mentioned that we don't have a whole lot to go on this week, so we're kind of hitting the more big theoretical kind of theme. But
One more kind of a political thing before we move on is, you know, President Biden announced he was putting Vice President Harris in charge on this voting rights issue, kind of the point person. And it seemed to me, I certainly understand what's called the optics of this, but of course, Vice President Harris doesn't exactly have deep ties in the Senate or is not known as a sort of legislative craftsperson or anything like that. And, you know, when she was in the Senate, she was pretty much always running for the presidency and held up the far left flank. So this is all about, I think, the optics of it. But it seems to me that were I in that position, I think I probably would have announced that I would like Joe Manchin to take charge of this issue and make it his baby. And then the frustration that he seems to feel with his Republican colleagues to make him own that. Not that I think that would make much of a difference, but I don't really think that I don't see this going anywhere, unfortunately. And I do think that's going to hurt the Democrats in the midterms, though not as much as a lot of doomsayers on the left think.
Yeah, well, I think the fact is the Democrats just don't have the numbers on the for the people vote. And it's more than just Sinema and Manchin. I think by and large, they will have.
Yeah.
That would be a tough vote for a lot of Democratic senators. And I just don't think they've got it. So they're gonna play it as the issue and have Kamala Harris because of the optics.
Yeah.
Get out there. So
and as I've said before, I think that the Democrats could have put together legislation that Joe Manchin would have would have at least been on board with, and that the For the People Act was just too broad to really pass, unfortunately. But something like the Lewis Act, I think, has a better chance of passing. That would have much more limited effect, as we talked about before. But honestly, it's getting harder and harder for me to see any of that happening. And I know you see that as a good thing. I see that as a bad thing, but not nearly as disastrously end of the Republic, end of the Democratic Party, as I think a lot of folks on the left who are kind of, you know, pushing this issue are. So,
yeah, I think that's right.
All right. Let's take a quick break and then we will come back and talk a little bit about the jobs report and the labor shortage. Everyone deserves nice things, but with all the markups in traditional luxury retail, high quality goods can be awfully expensive. Quince is different. They're a one-stop shop for essential products with low design costs. They've got tees, hoodies, loungewear, pants and shorts, blouses, dresses, skirts. I mean, unless you're a nudist, they've got something for you. And, you know, even if you are clothing optional, they've got home accessories, bedding, bath, decor, all sorts of good stuff. Quince finds the best factories and only partners with those committed to the highest production standards, fair wages, safety, and sustainability, which is particularly a big deal to me. And because Quince is shipping directly to you with no agents, stores, or other middlemen, you get great 100% factory direct prices on everything. I mean, I've been desperately in need of some new t-shirts, and I was really impressed by the price and quality of their organic Pima cotton selection. And my bath towels, honestly, are looking pretty ratty too, so Quince's great prices on high-quality Turkish bath towels, they really caught my eye. Quality shouldn't be a luxury. You deserve it. So try Quince today. Get free shipping and 365-day free returns by going to onequince.com/politicsguys. Many of their collections sell out immediately, so don't wait. You can save hundreds of dollars on clothing and accessories by going to onequince.com/politicsguys. That's onequince.com/politicsguys. Okay, Jay. So let's get into the jobs report that came out on Friday and the situation with labor. I know you have some thoughts about what's going on here, and I do too. Mine are probably going to be a little bit different than yours.
I do. As you hear in the back, Todd Rundgren playing, echoing sort of my thoughts on some what's going on here. But the last week's jobs report came up short. Surprisingly, it underperformed expectations. The economy created 559,000 new jobs, but at the same time, the labor force shrank by 53,000. Those are the sort of the big findings, and I think it's a little weird, and maybe the numbers are strange when we say created jobs. Because there are plenty of job openings, and typically when we say created jobs means there's an opening and someone took it. But I mean, I hate to move into the anecdotal, but Mike, I mean, haven't you also seen this, felt this? I know it's where I live. Every place you go has help wanted signs. Places are offering significant hiring bonuses, and the mood is, I mean, there are so many places that I've, you go and they say, please be patient because we just don't have staff to handle you. And Republicans have looked to, the fact that we've been paying an extra $300, per week. And, well, I guess we'll call it expanded unemployment benefits, as well as the numerous, other stimulus payments, and what's coming up next is going to be the child tax credit payments, which are going to be paid sort of ahead of time, so a little bit like a rolling stimulus, as opposed to just getting it when you file your taxes. Now, amidst this, wages annualized since March are up 24%. Now, again, that's annualized, right? So it's probably not that they would continue that increase. Mike, what are your thoughts on this? And is it an issue of the government is paying people to stay home, or that as Democrats tend to put it, the jobs just need to pay more?
Well, I mean, I do tend to think that the jobs just need to pay more, and that's really the issue. So I don't really have. I mean, it seems to me that a market based solution to this would be to say, well, if you are an employer and you are having trouble hiring people, well, that means that you need to offer more. And once you offer more, you know, I'll get into the anecdotal as well. I've seen a number of stories about businesses who said, you know, we were having a whole lot of trouble hiring people. Then we announced we were going to be offering a starting $15 an hour wage, and all of a sudden we had applications flooding in. And so I think there's a pretty simple solution to this problem is if you need more workers, you need to pay them more, and they will come.
But should these businesses, particularly small businesses, and what you say is entirely true, in terms of businesses competing with one another for employees, but should they have to compete with the federal government?
Yeah, and I think right? I think they absolutely should. Now, I think that competition.
I mean the federal government as
yeah
as
just I know what you
money
mean
as opposed to a federal government as an employer.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and yes, I agree that they should have to compete. Now, by compete in that sense, I believe, just like a lot of people on the left do, that there should be a minimum wage. Now, of course, there is a minimum wage, but that,
you got it.
Yeah, but I believe that minimum wage, you know, the current federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. It's been there for well over a decade, right? And now various states have different minimum wages of their own. And so what that minimum wage does is that is, in a sense, well, it's not competition, but like the direct payments, but it basically does set that floor. And I certainly believe that floor needs to be raised, and that's being done in sort of a different way, right? Because people are getting the equivalent, or can be getting on their unemployment, the equivalent of roughly $15 an hour for staying home, essentially. And so, yeah.
And actually, I've seen numbers when you count in all these other things, and also you consider that the staying at home money isn't subject to payroll taxes.
Right.
That in the 21 states, that the numbers could come up to $25 an hour.
Yeah. And now I would say short term, that's not a policy I would support long term, just continued enhanced unemployment payments. And in fact, those expire after Labor Day. So it's going to be roughly 3 months from now, those will expire. And I think that's
unless they're renewed.
Right. And I think that's a good thing. And I think it made sense to have that in place because a lot of people had, I think, real and understandable concerns, health concerns related to the pandemic. And by Labor Day, I believe we should be at a vaccination rate where most of those concerns should be reasonably allayed. And so this was a temporary measure, and I would not support it as a permanent measure. And so I guess that's how I feel about that specifically. But in terms of, you know, my larger issue is with the minimum wage, and I, like a lot of people on the left, would like to see a nationwide, you know, $15 minimum wage. I think that would be an excellent idea. I also would be very much in favor of phasing out the tip minimum wage, which federally is $2.13 an hour. Now, I don't think that should be phased out or that be ended directly, but maybe phased out over, you know, 10 years or something like that. So I would absolutely be in favor of that. And that, of course, would end up with the same sort of result for businesses, as they would have to pay potential employees more to get them to come on.
So, but again, looking at where we are now, I mean, isn't there a risk that we're seeing to some point that this inability to get people back to work is hampering the recovery?
Well, sure it is.
I
think it is, but I think there are also understandable health concerns. It's, you know, these things were put into place. I think a lot of people, well, everyone knows this, we're not dealing with just another recession. This was an enormous, completely unexpected shock to the system in so many ways. And so we have to weigh these. I mean, there are still, you know, vaccination rates are up, and that's great, but there are still people dying every day from this. And again, I said, I think this was a reasonable, these were reasonable temporary measures. I would not support them as permanent measures. And sure, doing some of this delays the recovery, but we're not talking about just an economic recovery. We're talking about a pandemic that has killed over 600,000 Americans. And right. You know, and
no, and I get all that. But what's the connection between that and an extra $1,200 a month?
It's that there are a number of people, especially people in very sort of high contact service industries, who feel understandably concerned about contracting COVID and taking it home to their families. Sure. And so therefore that extra money, I think, is understandable and helpful in the short term. And of course, for a while, there was also the additional factor of a number of businesses being closed, and now they're opening up again.
Right. And I think you're right on the businesses being closed piece. But for the person who is staying at home now and saying, look, I don't want to go back to work because I'm concerned about COVID, please pay me an extra $1,200 on top of unemployment, on top of stimulus payments. What's the incentive to get vaccinated? Right. I mean, what if you said, hey, we're stopping these payments as I think 21 states are now 25 states are now poised to do. Doesn't that send the message, look, you're going to have to go back to work, so go get vaccinated?
Sure. I guess, you know, you seem to be sure.
Or the option is not get vaccinated, stay home, keep collecting the money.
Well, except that money's going to run out after Labor Day. And I guess you seem to be a little more comfortable with a stick-based approach, and I seem to be a little more comfortable with a carrot-based approach, and maybe that's a difference more broadly on the left and the right.
I'm saying that the idea of a carrot-based approach would be like you hold the carrot out in front of the horse to make the horse go someplace. In your scenario, it seems you're just kind of sitting there feeding the horse carrots.
Yeah, I guess you're right. So it's more of a, I hate to use it, that I was thinking of a caring sort of nurturing based approach, and you're more of a sort of beat them over the head with the stick approach. That's painting it too broadly, certainly. But yeah, I think in general that we need to have a little more patience with this. And I think it's easy to overreact and say, well, we need to start these payments right now. They're going to be stopped in a few months, and the recovery will come on, and I think everything will be fine, but I think again that this, I agree with a lot of people on the left who say that this just sort of demonstrates, or has given people a greater understanding of, wow, you know, I'm in this horrible job, and a lot of people who are servers or work in kitchens or the hospitality industry, so-called, know that these are rough, oftentimes brutal jobs, and
I've done it.
Yeah, they don't pay very well at all. And I think a lot of people are saying, well, wait a second, why is that the case? And given the option to not do those horrific, you know, those really horrific is too strong, but these bad jobs at bad pay, people are saying, no, I'd rather not do that. And I think the answer to that is not to say, well, we're going to pull your support, go ahead and do it. I think the answer is to say, you know what, we're going to make sure that your employers are required to pay you a living wage to do these jobs. And I am very much in favor of a living wage.
Isn't there something else, though, that, and this, I mean, I'm very old fashioned, but I would hope you're sort of old fashioned in the same way, that it used to be that if you're an able bodied person and able to work and there is work available, there's something really sort of dishonorable about saying, look, I'm not going to work and I'm just going to keep collecting money from those who are.
Yeah. And I don't think most people feel that way. Most people,
whether they feel that way or not, you know, that's.
No, most people want to do something that they feel is meaningful and fulfilling and that pays them a reasonable wage for their efforts. And there are a lot of jobs that just aren't like that. You know, and so I think that's really the problem, is there are these awful jobs that don't pay much. And so, of course, people, if given an option, will not do those jobs. And so that's why I think, you know, for instance, if you take a look, if you take a look at kind of interesting thing I found this last week, something called the MIT Living Wage Calculator. And it basically goes through, it's a long involved sort of thing, but you can see what the living wage, their view of the living wage is for various conditions in various states, cities, metropolitan areas, that sort of thing. And for instance, for Cleveland, they calculated the living wage for two parents working with one child is $16.05 an hour. And of course, that's, you know, far higher than the federal, than the Ohio minimum wage, which I believe is $8.80 an hour, I think, or something like that, and well higher than the Ohio tip minimum wage of $4.40 an hour. And so I think that's the situation a lot of families are in, is they have these, they can get this employment, but it's awful employment, and it doesn't pay them really a living wage. It may keep them just above the poverty line, but I think we can do a lot better, which is why I think that the move for a $15 an hour national minimum wage, the sort of thing that voters in, you know, Republican Florida approved, I think that's the way to go.
Well, it's easy at some point to do that, say, hey, we're going to just raise the minimum wage. And then once the consequences come about, that's a different story. But going back to just the idea that, I mean, is it the job of the economy to provide self-fulfillment for people? Or is it, I mean, look, I think it's great if you can have a job that's self-fulfilling. And you feel is important and worthwhile, and that pays you well.
I believe that. Yeah, that's a good question.
I've had plenty of jobs that aren't. And the reason you do it is because you do it for the money, and because you have to, and because you're responsible for yourself and or your family. And it's not a matter of it to be this, again. This just strikes me as. To say that, look, I'm going to just stay home and collect money from other people who are working, because yeah, that job isn't quite what I want. I think that's a big moral problem.
Yeah, I believe it's a big moral problem to allow employers to shamelessly exploit workers, and that's what I feel happens in the labor market, especially at the lower ends of the labor market. And if you're going to ask somebody to do grueling and degrading labor, then I think that the federal government absolutely should say, if that's fine, but you're going to have to pay these people at least this minimum, and we're going to raise that minimum for what it is to make this a living wage, or at least something approaching a living wage. And so, yeah, I agree it's a moral problem, though I see the moral problem on the part of the employers who are allowed to exploit workers without any sort of consequence.
What do you, I mean, I guess, you know, looking at, say, the restaurant industry, small independent restaurants, they simply can't afford to pay the type of wages that may happen. And look, I think what you may end up with, for example, in fast food, particularly with the push to more electronic ordering and so forth, is, look, okay, then what we'll do, if you don't want to do this degrading, demeaning job, which, again, I sort of take issue with that, because there's a Republican principle, or at least it should be a Republican principle, that any job is worthwhile, that no job is degrading, that all work is there's something good and honest about doing it.
See, that's where, yeah, I would maybe degrading is the wrong word, but I certainly would argue that dehumanizing is when you are just basically, you know, if you spend 8 hours a day inserting whatever tab A into slot B on some sort of large line or something like that, that is, I think, by its very nature, dehumanizing work. And you're going to love my use of the Marxist terminology, but I believe that, you know, people are alienated, for workers in many cases are alienated from the products of their labor. And there's no real connection like there was in an earlier sort of pre-industrial era. And that does make a big, big difference. That wasn't certainly the circumstances that pertain for most people around the times of the founding of this country, but certainly in modern post-industrial America and the world in general, that absolutely is the case for an awful lot of workers. Most people aren't fortunate enough, like you and I are, to have work that is, in many cases, you know, intellectually challenging and varied and provides a certain level of fulfillment.
But maybe they don't want or need that all the time, right? I mean, like I said, there have been plenty of jobs I've taken that have not been intellectually
fulfilling. Now who's being...
But, you know, I did it, like, you know, right? Because that's what you do because you needed a job.
But now who's being patronizing? I mean, you talk about being patronizing on the left, saying that, well, maybe those people who aren't like us don't need meaning in their work. Maybe you're not saying that, and I just misheard you.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying all work is meaningful, right?
But that's just not true. I mean, that's simply, I would, that's why I guess where we disagree. I would say inherently, work in which you have a direct connection to your labor and you see the products of your labor and it's something that you feel that you can see a positive result in the world of, that is inherently more meaningful, more fulfilling than work in which that is not the case. And so I think to argue that all jobs have the same amount of meaning and it's just on the worker to find that in there, I think that's just not an accurate statement to make.
Well, I guess we'll disagree on that. But in the meantime, I guess we will just see how we get through this summer with so many of these shortages, because the places where they're, ironically, that the shortages are hitting the hardest are the places that have been hit hardest by the pandemic. And the other thing that we're going to see is inflation, right? There is no such thing as a free lunch, and inflation disproportionately is going to hit the folks on the lower end of the income scale. So.
And again, yeah. So we will certainly see. I think that this is all going to, I think that maybe both sides are jumping to their preferred ideological conclusions a bit too quickly, just given the fact that what we are going through is so very unprecedented. And maybe you will agree with me that oftentimes it's easy to kind of jump to those conclusions and that we're going to know a lot more, say, 5 or 6 months from now than we do today.
Well, when you inject this amount of money into the economy and subsidize not working, and then you sort of scratch your head, it's like, why? I wonder why people aren't going back to work. I don't know that you need a whole lot of study to see that people. Getting paid more not to work discourages them from going to work.
Sure, but what I'm saying is that this, assuming that the extended unemployment insurance is not extended, or that the extra unemployment insurance is not extended, I don't think that there's going to be these horrific consequences of this because it's not going to be extended. You think that the extra money is going to be extended? After Labor Day?
I think there's a possibility of it. Okay. Biden has indicated that he's not in favor of it, but, you know, he could change his mind. And even if it isn't extended, well, we've still got the problem through Labor Day. That's still keeping people out of the labor market artificially by having the government compete by paying them not to work. And again, so it's not a fair competition, right? To say, look, company A will pay you money for doing this. Company B will pay you money for this. Government will pay you, well, almost as much, if not more. We're just sitting at home watching TV.
And I mean,
that's not market competition. If you told me, look, yeah, you can make 80%, 50% of your income, and just sit home and do nothing. Would I take that? I mean, that's what they call retirement, right?
No, but you wouldn't, and most people would, because most people don't want to sit home and do nothing. People have I think maybe you disagree with this, but people have a desire for meaning and connection and doing things that matter in their lives. And so work is the way that we do this. And so I think the idea...
No, it's not. Oh, that's the thing. Work may be one of the ways we do that.
Sure.
But what about, you know, family, friends, organizations, religion, hobbies? I mean, there's a whole lot of there are plenty of people out there who may work some kind of crummy day job that they don't find intellectual fulfillment in. But you know, every weekend they go fishing and they really love it. And that's their thing. And that's where they find their meaning. And they work hard doing this job that they don't like, in order to be able to do other stuff that they do like. When they're off work. So, I mean, I think it's great if you can find meaning in your job. But this could be sort of like my commencement address. Right. I mean, so many of these, like, oh, if you love what you do, you'll never work another day in your life. Well, no, that's bullshit. But I think you can.
No, I agree with you.
My commencement address is get a damn job.
I agree with you about that. Right. But I also believe that if you are going to ask somebody to do a job that does not provide that sort of thing, then it's not unreasonable for government to say, you know what, we're going to make sure that at least you have to pay that person a living wage to do that job. That's nobody's idea of, you know, wonderful, meaningful, fulfilling, life-affirming type of work. And that's where you and I would part company on that.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that pretty much takes us. We thought we were going to get into the crime issue, but we will get into that, except that will be on the bonus show. But before we get to that bonus show, I think we have some recommendations to close today, right, Jay?
Yeah. So my recommendation, and this is going to be, Mike, you're going to think terribly elitist, but again, it's sort of a narrow audience, but Ward Farnsworth is the dean of the University of Texas Law School. And he's written a number of books on writing and speaking. The first one being The Elements of Classical English Style, and another Elements of Classical English Rhetoric and Classical English Metaphor. And if you're into writing, speaking, doing it better, these books are absolutely fantastic because it sort of breaks down all the different methods, the different tools of the trade, and provides just wonderful examples. If nothing else, the books are fun to read just for the examples they provide, from, you know, it's Shakespeare, Churchill, Lincoln, et cetera, saying this is how you do it. And I think it would be fantastic improvement in our political rhetoric if members of Congress would read these books, and also just people, writers of op-eds and my God, like the kids at Vox, you know, really just. But anyway, Ward Farnsworth and Mike. Also, interestingly, he's also written a book on Stoicism.
Hmm. I love that name, Ward Farnsworth. It sounds like somebody who, if he did not go to an Ivy League school, I kind of picture him somewhere in I don't know, in Greenwich or something like that. You know,
on the book jacket? Yes, he very much looks like you would expect Ward Farnsworth to look like.
Yeah. I guess the only way it could make it better is he were Ward Farnsworth III or something like that.
Yes. So,
but, you know, maybe his kid will carry on that line. I don't know. All right. Well, we will have a link for that in the show notes. I guess I might have mentioned this a while ago. I'll have sort of not necessarily a recommendation. Could it be an anti-recommendation? I don't know. A while ago, with great excitement, I picked up a copy of the first volume in Barack Obama's autobiography, memoirs, I guess they call them, A Promised Land. You know, I ended up bailing on this 701-page book I checked before page 100. I feel like it should have been called something like, I don't know, Allow Me to Explain, or Why Everything I Did Was Absolutely the Best Thing I Could Have Done Under the Circumstances, Except for Some Like Minor Things That Kind of Humanize. Anyway, I hate political autobiographies. I don't know why I thought this one would be different. They just feel so incredibly self-serving and false, you know, in a way. And even from someone who, as a politician, I admire, like Barack Obama, greatly admire. God, it was just painful to read the purple prose and just the campaign type talk. I mean, you know, language just.
Oh, and this is like the third of such books, right? I mean, that's the other thing. I mean,
yeah, and it doesn't
really.
It's
almost like he really likes writing books about himself.
This is bipartisan, of course. I mean, politicians are raised as politicians, whatever, conform themselves into this mold. And I think it just warps their minds, for better or for worse. And so
it's for the same reason I'm not going to read the John Boehner book.
Exactly. You know, though I got to say, I maybe am a little more inclined to read the Boehner book just because it looks like it's a little more
fun,
a little more earthy, I guess. Yeah. But it was disappointing, I suppose. I kind of expected more of a insidery, honest thing, which was dumb of me, and I should have known better. So mea culpa on that. But I love Barack Obama, but God, political autobiographies are just painful unless you're interested in just kind of, you know, hagiography, which I guess almost all autobiographies are to a certain extent. So there you go. All right. Well, I don't know if they should put a link on that for that. But okay. Anyway, on our bonus show, which we will be recording in just a minute, which will be available to Patreon supporters Wednesday morning, we will be talking about rising big city crime. We'll be talking a little bit about Pride Month, President Biden's proclamation, and that Florida law about not allowing transgender women in women's sports. And of course, the truth. Is it out there? The UFO report? That should be a fun thing to talk about as well. And maybe we'll even get to some listener mail if we have the time. And all of that will be in your feed Wednesday morning if you're a Patreon supporter. If you're not, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And again, if you would like to get that bonus show, but you can't afford to support the podcast right now, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will make sure you get that midweek show. And if you haven't already subscribed to the show, that is a big help, as are ratings and reviews, and especially sharing episodes on social media. That makes a big difference. A special thanks to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, Nathan Sosnowski, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.